From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show, and we are on a mission to ignite the entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. And you know, we do that here in Sacramento by building the Backyard Advantage, the most connected community in the world for local entrepreneurs. And it's centered around love, right? We help each other in Sacramento. That's the way we do it. It is beginning to happen. We are turning a corner in this effort to ignite an entrepreneurial revolution. And really, you know, we're showing love to one another here in Sacramento. And it's really fun to watch. On today's show, we're going to have a member of that Backyard Advantage, Chris Russell. He's a corporate partner at Stoll Reeves. Stoll Reeves is a local accounting firm. Well, I shouldn't say that. They're all over the West Coast, but they have a strong regional presence here in Sacramento, and they do corporate law. Anything that you want to know about legal and business, you know, Stoll Reeves is a tremendous resource, and they're an incredible value and supporter of entrepreneurship in our region. And today, Chris Russell is going to be sharing really a little bit about how Sacramento entrepreneurship and venture capital has changed over the years, because we've come a long way over the last 10 or 20 years. And really, the improvement and the growth, it's accelerated over the last 4 or 5 years. I'm going to talk a little bit about that at the end of the show. But Chris is also going to share with us some interesting answers to what startups are asking, right? We have startups that, you know, can barely afford to get legal advice. So we're going to give you some great legal information for if you're starting a business and, you know, you've got some basic questions about the legal structure of your business and other questions that you're going to want to have answers to. Well, stick around, because Chris is going to answer some of those questions for you. But before we get into that, we're gonna bring on Jay Ezell. He's gonna be sharing one quick answer that you are gonna need to know if you are successful in building a business that that has a lot of value. And so he's gonna be answering an important question, and it, really around what to do. Is my business transferable? And, you know, a question about attracting multiple buyer personas. And because when you go to sell your business, you don't want to have just one buyer. It's better to have multiple buyers, because guess what? If multiple buyers get excited about something, now you supply and demand kicks in, and you're going to get a little bit more money for your business. So stick around, enjoy the show. I'll hit you up at the end of the show. Stick around, my friends.
Entrepreneurs are the heroes of the American economy. They take the risks, create the opportunities, and move the molecules. Now, back to the Marquee Media Studio, it's the Mark Haney Show.
All right, question number two. Is my business transferable and attractive to multiple buyers?
Sure. Yeah, that's a really, really important question to ask, because as we found with most founders are the guy that, or the people that wear the most number of hats. They're the upfront salesperson on the front end. They're running the business. They might be the CFO behind the door. And the trouble is, if you've got somebody, whether it's inside or outside the organization, that's going to take over and fill your shoes, can they? Meaning if you're the person with all the key customer contacts, well, the relationship sits with you. And if you're no longer there, it's not necessarily the same transferable businesses they're looking to acquire. So that's, again, part of the exercise is saying, how can you, through efficient, strategic thought and planning, start to work yourself out of a job at the end of the day? That's really what you have to do, to step back to where those people that can remain still run the business, the business continues to grow without you serving in all those roles.
So your company is more valuable when you work yourself out of a job.
Well, yeah, potentially, yeah. Because it's the longevity of the business remains. It's much more transferable. And when you've got a strategic acquirer coming in, somebody outside, so if I own a manufacturing company that makes a widget and there's a larger one from the East Coast that wants my geography, they don't necessarily want me to stay there. They want the customer base. They want all of those connections and things like that. So it makes it more attractive. And that's important when you start to think about valuation and multiples and things like that.
I'm rising up from the ground, from the bottom. Can't hold me down, hold me down. I'm rising.
Entrepreneurship is a full contact sport. It's not for the timid. It's not for the cowards. Only the strong survive. And now, back to the Marquee Media Studio, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Today on the show, we have corporate partner from Stoll Reeves, Mr. Chris Russell is in the house. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing great, thanks. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too. You've been on the show before. We've talked about the law a little bit and, you know, stuff that entrepreneurs need to know about, you know, stuff that's going on with legal. And I have actually, a little later in the show, I have a list of questions. I use ChatGPT to form a list of 10 the most common questions that startup founders ask these days. So if we get time, maybe I'll quiz you on some of these questions. I know that's a little bit of a surprise because we wanted to talk really about the evolution of what's happening in the entrepreneurial ecosystem in Sacramento, and also get into what's going on with the changes that you're making in terms of how you are supporting with the Backyard Awards and the Innovation Awards. So maybe first, let's just get a little bit of your background and then we'll dive into all of it.
All right, sounds great. Well, I've been practicing longer than I'd like to admit, but I've been practicing since the 80s. And I've been working in a variety of different ways with emerging companies as they went through that from the late 80s until now. And so I was highly involved with the entrepreneurship economy that was trying to, in its early stages in Sacramento. And
Maybe I'll stop you there. What did we look like in the 80s? So in the I graduated from high school in 81, which was a long time ago. And all I knew, I didn't even know what the word entrepreneurship meant until probably about 10 years ago. And because I knew small business, right? Mm-hmm. My dad had a TV shop. I mean, we ended up having video stores and security, but it was really more like Main Street type of businesses. What did it look like in the 80s for somebody who didn't even have a clue?
It was very small. There were...
Monthly. We're talking about Sacramento.
Sacramento.
Right. Okay.
Sacramento only. Mm-hmm. We had monthly meetings, and there would probably be about 20 people who would show up, and there would be a presentation. And so people who were just getting to understand what was going on, what was the needs to be able to make an entrepreneurial economy to exist. And, you know, we all knew the elephant in the room was that the problem with getting this really grow started was two things. One is, you know, we weren't the Silicon Valley, so we didn't have the experience of some of the people who are serial entrepreneurs who have gone through this many, many times, who could then help younger entrepreneurs develop and become entrepreneurs themselves.
Right.
And we didn't have any money. And the interesting thing was at the time, where at least it was perceived here in Sacramento, is that people in Silicon Valley would fly to Denver, but would not drive to Sacramento.
Crazy.
And so that was some of the mentality that we had to deal with in that time period, was Sacramento was deemed by the Bay Area as being not an entrepreneurial economy, but more like a government town, mm-hmm. cow town, those types of things, a pass-through town. It wasn't someone that they really focused on in terms of having the resources to be able to make it a strong entrepreneur.
Well, even in the early 80s and mid 80s, I mean, it was still pretty new. I mean, venture capital, I guess it goes back, you know, hundreds of years, but really it became popular with some of the tech companies in the Bay Area, the Silicon Valley. And then it, you know, it just didn't catch on in very many places. And I think some would say it's starting to catch on in Sacramento, but walk me through this history. So you've been helping in this realm. You've been advising in this realm and leading in this realm. So we got the 80s when guys like me didn't even know what the word entrepreneurship meant. Maybe take us into the 90s and 2000s, and who are some of those people, and what did it look like as the years progressed?
Yeah, I mean, there were some real early people who put a lot of energy into trying to develop this, including the lawyer, Jill Zatia, with whom I worked with early on in my career. He was at DLA, and he really put a big part of his practice in early stage companies. And then you have John Gregory at Five Star Bank, who was then running a program where there's, you know, hundreds of people would show up at a pitch fest. And then you had people like Kerry Adams, who was one of the founders of Sarda, that they pulled together. John Gregory, Kerry, and the chamber pulled together to form the organization, which became Sarda. And then then you had people like Oleg and
Oleg Kaganovich. Yeah, he's, you know, it's interesting. John Gregory, Five Star Bank now, is still involved in this realm. He's actually, he didn't give up on it. He, I think he took a couple of veers here and there, but he's back, and he's leading, helping lead this charge. Oleg Kaganovich, same thing. He's still in this, leading this, even though he's, you know, he had a startup and, you know, he's done some different things. So it's kind of addicting, I suppose. People want to come back to this asset class and to this risk. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting.
Yeah, no. So and then you had Sarda, which had, you know, they decided that they needed to focus on three different technologies areas: MedStart, AgStart, and I can't remember the third one. But yeah, they were MedStart and AgStart was founded by Sarda, and though you have AgStart now existing still in Woodland, which,
yeah,
was
John Selp is running that. Yeah,
came from the Sarda group, so John was a big part of that aspect as well, and then you started to see where other types of people were looking at. I mean, we started putting ourselves on the map somewhat, and some people started to raise some money. There was some successes like Power School. I represented them when they were doing their financing round and then sold to Apple.
Wow.
In 2001. And so you had some early successes from those types of organizations. And then you started to see people starting to look at Sacramento as really, yeah, there are some people that have some talent to really take these on to the next level.
You know, it's interesting. Success breeds some success. So we stand on the shoulders of the people like you and Power School and the other names we've mentioned. And there's so many others that, you know, helped build this. And there was a lot of two steps forward, one step back, I know, along the way. When I got involved in this ecosystem in 2015, when did you start the Innovation Awards? When did that begin?
We started that in 2016.
2016. So I started my podcast in 2015. And I think I emceed one of the Innovation Awards. Was it your first one? Oh,
yeah.
Okay. So I remember meeting you at that time and being sort of impressed that you wanted to recognize the same things that I wanted to do on my show, is recognize people that were taking risks and getting out there, and you were focused on innovation. And maybe let's talk about the Innovation Awards and now it's changing. Talk to us about the origin of why you started it and what it means to Stoll Reeves, what it means to the Sacramento ecosystem, and then, you know, where is it going?
Yeah, sure. First of all, I mean, Stoll Reeves has been putting on an Innovation Award program in some of his other jurisdictions for 20 years before that. So there were, we were doing it in our Salt Lake City office, in our Boise office, and we had one going on in our Seattle office. And so we decided this was a good place for a similar type of program here in Sacramento. So we pulled together some of the key leaders. We looked at what the growth economy had done before that, what they had highlighted as the principal industries that the Sacramento region was focused on. And we built our award program based upon those categories. And so we tried to support what Sacramento saw as its growth path, and we tried to recognize that.
Yeah.
And so that was the innovation of that. And so we started that program in 2016, and we ran that program for many years, and then COVID hit, and it kind of changed how we were, you know, how people were getting together. And we also, in our other jurisdictions where we had done this in these other cities, we had partnered with, you know, people who were focused in on working on innovation economies in those particular cities. And so when we were looking at doing a reevaluation of how we might want to look at to continue the innovation awards or highlight the people's successes in our area in this way, we were looking at other partners that would be who could fit those particular and have the same drive and energy for those types of things. And we saw what Growth Factor was doing with his GFX program. I went there last year, saw the number of people that attended. And that seemed like the, you had the people there who were celebrating all the innovation, and it seemed like a good program to kind of bring the innovation award programs to. And so we're calling it the Backyard Awards in connection with the GFX event that will occur in October.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate that partnership, and we look forward to working together with you to make this a great event. Last year, GFX had about 600 people. We expect at least double this year. And right in the heart of it will be the Backyard Awards. We'll be recognizing local innovation, local entrepreneurs. And you know, I know you're still working on the details of that, so we can't really share too much. But it is October 5th at the grounds in Roseville. And GFX, again, it's a great place to meet the people that really care about this, you know, this asset class, these people that are taking these risks and really changing the world. And it's happening right here in Sacramento. But I remember the first time, okay, I remember emceeing that in the original one in 2016. And one of my portfolio companies, I was an angel investor a brand new angel investor at that time. And one of my portfolio companies, Freeform, was the first electric jet ski invented. No sales. They ended up, but it was a great technology. Jordan Darling ended up selling his idea to Nikola, which ended up going public. And, you know, so, it worked out pretty well for Jordan and the investors. But, you know, you began celebrating those. It's those type of success stories where people go, oh, well, if Jordan Darling, I think, was 23. When he sold his company. I mean, if Jordan can do this, maybe I can do that too. So it is kind of infectious.
Plus, Jordan becomes a role model and a mentor for other people in the region. I mean, that's one of the things that you to really build an innovation economy in any city, you need to have people who have experience. One of the big issues that we always faced early on in the 2000s and such was that one of the biggest complaints that we had from people in the Bay Area is that we didn't have the talent here in this region. And it was hard to draw talent from the Bay Area because they were so interconnected with their communities that if they felt like they left that community and came out to Sacramento, they would lose whatever connections they had in the Bay Area at that point in time. So we had to grow our talent. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we have the peoples like Jordan's and Greg Porter who started Power School. You have other people like that who became examples and mentors, mm-hmm, that help people to go to the next level.
Yeah, it's really cool. So in terms of where we go from here, so this year we're doing it October 5th. It's going to be a great time. And like when you look at other ecosystems that you've seen, because we have, I don't know if it's enough critical mass, but we have some critical mass in Sacramento that as you extrapolate where we're going from just like 2 or 3 years ago to, you know, 2 or 3 years from now, we're on a faster trajectory than we were in the 80s. Now it's like we've hit that, I guess, critical mass and that turning point, and things are starting to roll.
And I think the part of it is the perception is that, you know, you've had successes and now people think that, you know, this is a good place to invest in this area. Money is what makes it grow. And when you have, when I talk to early stage companies now, it was, you know, $100,000 here, $100,000 here. Now they have access to, you know, tremendous amount of capital. If you have a good product and you have a good team, it's likely that you could get financed. Yeah. You couldn't have said that in the 2000s and the 90s.
Yeah, it's amazing that this asset class was underrepresented with local money. Local money was investing into, there wasn't as much local money, but it was investing into real estate predominantly and other things. So now we have people that want to invest. We have 100 investors in the Growth Factory. Some of the other venture funds around town have a lot of investors as well. And it's not all the same people, right? There's a lot of, you know, we even have the SAC Angels and, Moneta Ventures and Impact and others. They all have a lot of investors, and we've pulled a lot of that money off the sidelines with, you know, introductions to this asset class. And there is an appetite for this because it's high risk, but it could be high reward too. People want to be a part of the Jordan Darling story.
Yeah. I mean, everybody's seen the unicorns and how much money you can make on a unicorn. And so it's, they should have this. I mean, if you have money that you can, allocate towards expenditures, this should be an asset class that you should look at, because there's, even though there's a lot of risk, there's also a lot of reward.
Yeah, there is. We had Jay Ezell. He's a guy that does planning. And we talked about this on the show, just might've been last show, and almost like, you can't put a big percentage, and this is not financial advice, folks, but you can't put a big percentage of your, net worth into venture capital. But you can, it's not a bad idea to hedge some bet in this realm if you've got a longer term time horizon. And so we're seeing that happen. People are understanding that now. And even wealth managers and people like that are starting to advise that. So,
cool. And I think there's also been a shift in the viewpoint of how people view Sacramento too, in terms of how there's not a wall between here and the Bay Area. I mean, it is a continuation of the Bay Area to Sacramento. And, at the early stage of when we were doing this in the 90s and 2000s, some of the people really wanted just to, because we were not getting the resources from the Bay Area, we really wanted to be homegrown and said, this is Sacramento. But I think what was important was to say, it's not just Sacramento. It's an it's part of an overall broader economy, ecosystem where there's innovators are coming from the Bay Area. There's money coming from different places. Now people don't work just in one city. I mean, they work. Right. They're all over.
Yeah, and the U-Haul report would tell you that people want to come to the Sacramento region, Placer County, El Dorado Hills, and the greater Sacramento region is growing. While a lot of California is, shrinking a little bit. So, but they're coming here. It's a great place to. Wow. Now, why did you stay here? Obviously, you could have in venture capital. This isn't the hot spot, and you've got an expertise in that realm. Why stay here?
I really wanted I had this choice. I mean, I was with another law firm beforehand, and I knew that I was that law firm wasn't really going to continue a presence in the region. I really wanted to stay in the region. I really wanted to work with local companies, use my expertise here, and so Stoll Reeves provided a great platform for me. And so because I had this platform and this ability to be able to, work in this particular area, and they gave me the ability to grow this particular space, that's why I decided to come. So it is an entrepreneur's experience.
Opportunity.
For me.
Yeah. You took the opportunity, and look, it's starting to get there. That hard work is beginning to pay off, I assume. Yes. Okay. So one of the things, anything else we want to talk about in terms of the backyard awards?
I guess the only other thing I would just point out is that we were principally focused on the innovation, so the product itself in the original awards. I think we're going to be looking at it as in a more broader sense now. I mean, getting input from other people to look at true innovation, and true innovation is just not a product. It could be a lot of different ways in which innovation. It could be an innovation team coming together and things like that. So I think we'll be expanding the way we're looking at it. We'll be looking at categories that fit for Sacramento region and what we want to do. It's Sacramento region will determine the categories and what they want. So that's where I think we're headed.
That's great. I love what you're doing. And thanks for teaming up with us to, so that we can bring what we've got to the party as well. And it's going to be a great time. Again, it's October 5th. It's GFX at the Grounds. And in future years, we're already planning to make GFX a heck of a lot bigger, taking it probably into Sacramento in years to come and really having it be this attraction where people come from potentially all over the world and, you know, definitely from around the state. We already have people coming from around the state into GFX. We've started to line up our speakers now for GFX. And so, you know, some of the, I mean, it's becoming a pretty decent lineup. And so I'll be talking about that in future shows. Now, one of the things I mentioned at the beginning of the show is that I was going to have ChatGPT challenge you. And are you ready to step up to that challenge?
Ready, let's go.
Okay, whatever you want to ask an attorney you know, here's some free, I don't know if you have to do a disclaimer about legal advice, but here, we get to ask a great attorney from a startup founder perspective, the most common questions according to ChatGPT. So here they are. What is the best legal structure for my startup, such as a sole proprietorship, partnership, limited liability company, LLC, or a corporation?
I have this question a lot because I am on the LegalNet team for the Venture Catalyst program at UC Davis. So a lot of the early stage people who are working with at UC Davis, like students, researchers, and other people, they're typically, you know, they're trying to commercialize some of the technology that comes out of the university. And sometimes they're doing it just in the form of a grant, and they just needed an organization just to be able to apply for a grant. But it really kind of depends upon where you're going, what you're doing, whether or not you're going to be raising capital from other people and things like that. I can just say from a general standpoint that if you're looking to raise money from institutional investors, the most likely organization you're going to have is a Delaware corporation.
Delaware C Corp. Yeah, okay, so I'm going to dive into this a little bit. As long as we ask the question from ChatGPT, I think it's important because since it's such a common question, I get this kind of question as well. And I own a number of companies myself. I've been an investor, so I've invested into some Main Street companies like restaurants. I've invested into tech companies. And the tech companies that are going to go out and attract venture capital and angel investors, yeah, they're Delaware C Corps for the most part. It just makes sense, and there's a lot of reasons why. And but small business, you know, how do you decide whether you're going to do an LLC or a sole proprietorship or an S Corp?
Yeah, so let's start with, I mean, you don't want, I mean, the sole proprietorship is not a legal entity. You have, it's just you. And you have all liability. You have, you know, there's no protection of liability. It's just whatever you do. If the business gets sued, it's coming out of your pocket.
Yeah, we should have ChatGPT take that off of the question.
Yeah, that's not the best structure.
Do not do the sole proprietorship
unless you have plenty of insurance. I do talk to people about that. So
I mean, but yeah, I mean, why?
But I look at LLCs for a couple things. One is if the business model is such that they're intending to make distributions of cash out of the business and not reinvest the money back into the company, then if you're intending to make distributions out, if you were a corporate form, you would have a tax at the corporate level, and then you would have a shareholder level tax and a dividend form. And so it's a two-level tax, and it's not very efficient that way. And so if you're intending to make a distribution of, you know, like royalty companies, or if it's going to be revenue that's going to be pushed out or to investors and such like that, then an LLC or a pass-through is the one that would make the most sense in that context, because it's not taxed at the entity level. It's only taxed at the member level.
So an S-Corp and an LLC, they're both pass-through entities. So I hold like stuff like real estate in and LLCs, but we have operating businesses that sell stuff. We still take distributions from those companies. So can you hone in on that for me a little bit? How do you decide whether to do the S Corp or, you know, because they're both basically, both basically pass-throughs.
Yeah. That's an easy question to answer with you. The S Corporation is a statutory creature, and it has very, very strict rules. And it, you know, you can only have one class of stock, so you can't have an investor with a class A preferred stock and a common stockholders. That doesn't work in an S corporation, so it doesn't work for a lot of investors in that way. it can only have natural people. So you couldn't have a VC come in and make an investment in S Corporation. It has to be a person that makes that investment, because if you have a non-natural person, it tends to go towards, you know, like service companies and things like that, which are, you know, that kind of model works for them. If you're wanting to have multiple classes of investors, have a distribute the funds in a different way other than just pure ownership interest, then an LLC is the better way to do it.
Okay, got it. Okay, next question, number two. What steps do I need to take to protect my intellectual property, my IP, and ensure that I have proper ownership rights?
Well, ownership is different from protection, just to be clear. You want to take the steps, like when you are forming your company and you're operating your company at the beginning, you're going to have employees or other people touch your technology. And you want to make sure that anybody who touches your technology enters into an agreement with the company that says, whatever I do, any invention that I have, the company owns. So that's one way in which you capture ownership of that particular technology. That's really, really important. And it also really kind of depends upon the other aspect of it is how you go through the protection of that other, you know, how you can protect it from other people from using it. Well, it really kind of depends upon the nature of the technology itself.
There's a lot of things that are really tough to protect. Is that right? There are people that create a software platform that is hard to say is differentiated enough to get patented.
Yeah. And at that point in time, what you rely upon is trade secret rules. And so in order for something to be protectable as a trade secret, meaning that, if one of your employees decides to go off and start another business using your trade secret information, you need to be able to have protected your trade secret so that that person cannot use it going forward.
Does that show up in your policy handbook, or do you have to have a special agreement with the employee?
Well, you do with the proprietary assignment agreement that I talked about at the beginning. You limit, in order for something to be treated as a trade secret, it has to have value for not being known to the general public. And so like the Coca-Cola formula is the most easy one to do that. It has value. It's sitting in the safe, and because nobody else knows what that is. And you need to take efforts to maintain that confidentiality in order for the courts to protect that right. So you need to limit access to the type of that information to need to know basis. And you need to have agreements in place that says that they're not going to go out and disclose it with someone else. And anybody who touches it, you know, they need to have non-disclosure agreements in place. Those types of things will help protect and allow you to be able to protect it as a trade secret.
Okay. What legal document? This is number three. What legal documents do I need when starting a business, such as founder agreements, employment contracts, non-disclosure agreements, and NDAs, and terms of service? How important are those?
They're all very important, and some of this will depend upon the type of organization that you create. I mean, if you're creating a corporation, you have one set of documents that you would need. And then if you have an LLC, you have another set of documents that you would use. Whenever someone when they go through the Venture Catalyst program at UC Davis, I give them a set of form documents, and the form documents that I give them are NDAs, and an offer letter for employees. I mean, the employment aspect of it is really just important to be able to define what the relationship is. If you were wanting to put more meat on the bone in terms of that, then an employment agreement would make more sense. If someone wants to have a severance or things like that, which might be outside of the ordinary that you offer any other employee.
You know, something jogged my memory or jogged a thought. You said form agreements, and we all know there's LegalZoom and things like that. And there's times when people do that. It's cheap, it's quick, and it's more of a generic type of document. But now we have ChatGPT, and I keep thinking about how did LegalZoom change your industry, right? You're an attorney, and how do you see for ChatGPT?
I think that they both have the same problem. I've seen a lot of people who go to LegalZoom, form entities, come to me, and it's wrong.
Oh.
And so then it requires to be fixed. And so, you know, and then the cost to fix it sometimes is greater than the original cost to do it. But because you're not having a legals, you know, someone who's really kind of thinking about it on the outside of it. But that being said, the form documents, I think, have been very beneficial because it provides a way. I mean, like when I give form documents, I will say, here's my form. You can use it for this type of thing. And, you know, and if you have questions, come back and talk to me. And that way I'm instructing them on the types of ways that it can be used. It's not just a general form. I know generally what they're trying to do. And I will help them identify the appropriate type of form. And then it saves them money and, you know, saves me time.
Okay. How do I navigate the process? This is number four. How do I navigate the process of raising funds and issuing equity to investors? And what legal considerations should I keep in mind?
This is a very broad question. It really kind of depends upon, you know, the terms of that investment. I mean, is it, two parties coming together to form something and they're all chipping in something? That's one way.
Well, let's talk about it from the startup founder who's got a tech company. He did a Delaware C Corp. He's done all the right things. Now he's taking on some angel investors and looking to get venture capital in the future. What, you know, there's convertible notes, there's safe notes, there's straight equity. Mm-hmm. How do you navigate those kind of decisions?
Yeah. Part of it is dictated by the investor. I mean, you would use, for the most part, the reason why safe notes have been created was to be able to fit in that space where you have an early stage company who are trying to raise money, but they don't want to spend a lot of money in legal fees. And the safe notes have been put together in a way that is kind of like equal balancing of the, you know, rights for the company and the ones for the investors. I think the safe notes work for small amounts of money. When you get to larger amounts of money, I don't think people quite understand how the safe note converts. And so, because it's usually on a pre-money valuation, I mean, they just think I'm raising money and here it is. And they don't quite understand because it could have some significant ramifications on their cap table going forward.
Yeah, this is a simple agreement for future equity. So you basically don't have the equity in the company. You put in the money and it converts something triggers that.
Yeah, whenever you do the next round of financing. And so the reason why you use that, though, is because the parties are not in a position really to determine value of the company.
Right.
And so if they knew what the value of the company was, early stage company is hard to value, as you may know. But because they can't really come to a value, the safe notes is a push. It says, okay, we will wait until you're a little bit bigger and you have an institutional investor come in and price it. And then we'll be converting based on that price. It could either be at a discount or it could be at a cap on the valuation. There's a variety of different ways in which it could work. But I recommend those types of things, either that or and convertible notes make sense to, if it's a much more complicated type of investment, more money involved with it, because then usually the investor would want to have more rights than what you would have in a safe and those types of things. So it's more of a negotiated piece.
Okay, so question number six, how can I draft and negotiate contracts with suppliers, customers, and partners to protect interest and minimize risks? That's kind of a weird question. How can I...
Yeah, I mean, I think what when I talk about it with suppliers, I mean, you might have supply agreements with people. Mm-hmm. It's where a supply agreement has a different. I mean, either based upon the quantity that you want to buy, or it could be on your requirements. You have someone who's agreeing to provide this to you, and then it also provides rights that if they can't supply it, what you might be able to do. So there does provide some basis by which, and it becomes some form of value too, because if an investor is looking at it, they see that you have a supply of these types of things, it provides
it. If it's a long term contract, it might have some real value. If you have some kind of exclusivity in a territory, that might have some value. So just it's an interesting question, is how can I draft? It's kind of a lot of these are pretty broad.
Yeah, there's supply agreements, distribution agreements. There's a variety of things that commercial agreements that you would enter into. Basically, you would need to do that. Like if you are a company, you have a product, but you want someone else to manufacture the product, you need to have an agreement with the manufacturer, licensing them the right to use your technology in the manufacturing process, but also limiting their right to be able to do it, anything other than that. So you can't just say, go to someone and says, can you manufacture this product with you? And if they, you know, if they make a little bit of an improvement in that product, they own that IP. So you need to have an agreement in place to help you with that manufacturer that dictates whatever you're doing is for me. Yes. And you can't do it for yourself.
Good point. I mean, great point. Okay, so number seven, what are the potential legal risks and liabilities I may face as a startup founder, and how can I mitigate them?
The one thing that I see most in startup founders is how they deal with equity. I mean, the biggest problem I see is people, whenever they come together, they'll say, okay, I'll give you 50% and I'll take, 25%. And they're working in these percentage numbers. And then as you issue stock, what does these percentage numbers mean? Is it what it was originally before we issued stock, or is it what it is now? So it becomes very complicated, and people need to document this. I mean, and if one of the, when you have a founders, if you have another co-founder, and you give them 50% of the stock, and then the next day they leave, they have 50% of the stock. And so you're working you're working for them for half of the value of the company. So you need to have something in place that says that if this founder leaves, then I have the right to buy it back. And that's usually in a restricted stock purchase agreement. But this becomes problematic if you don't do this up front, because if you have a restricted stock purchase agreement, you could have some tax consequences that you don't want to have unless you file something with the IRS within 30 days of doing this. And if you don't hit that 30-day window, you don't get it back. So,
yeah, I don't know if ChatGPT is going to be able to explain that. So, yeah, I think you might need an attorney to figure out some of these things. But I think it's kind of – I have actually heard the percentage – where you promise somebody 50% or 30%, and then it gets diluted when you take on other investors. Do I still own my 50 or 30%? No, you don't. Well, you promised me, right? So
right. Yeah,
that's, I can see that being really awkward and problematic, as you said.
It's always renegotiations with your founders at that point. And if someone's left, it's a difficult conversation.
Oh, I can imagine. Okay, are there any, this is number eight, are there any specific laws or regulations that apply to my industry or nature of my startup's product or service? Yes?
It could be.
Yeah.
Depends upon the nature of your products and service.
Yeah.
There are highly regulated industries, but most of them, most startup companies are not operating in a highly regulated industry. So you just need to know what your industry is and what kind of restrictions you might have.
Okay. What are the potential legal implications of hiring employees, including related to labor laws and benefits and contracts?
Yeah. So California made it really difficult for early stage companies because they have, we passed AB 5, which says that, it makes it very difficult to have someone who's not an independent, and not an employee. If they're providing an essential part of your business and services providing an essential part of your business, they should be treated as employees under California law. And what that means is that they have rights. They have employment rights. They have rights to minimum wage. They have rights to, certain benefits, and you have to deal with all these particular things. So
yeah,
many early stage companies don't, they just wish that didn't happen.
Yeah, we basically, the risk, since it's an interesting question as a startup founder, look, we have no sales, we're just getting off the ground, nobody's taking a salary, we're giving each other the verbal, probably a verbal piece of the action, just partnering to get off the ground. We're working 90 hours a week. Of course we're not, even if we were getting paid minimum wage, we would be, under minimum wage. It's almost like it's impractical to follow labor laws when you have no revenue.
It is a challenge.
Yeah.
What I found is that most early stage companies, you know, we advise them on the, you know, the issues related to that. I mean, that what happens is that if someone leaves, and that was who has been working with you, and they have the right to go to the EDD and make a claim. I mean, but the ultimately, if you don't have any money,
right?
What are you going to get out of it? So I mean,
it's an interesting thing we have, and again, they don't have enough money to hire an attorney to get this advice because they're a startup, and so it's a difficult thing. There are outsourced HR firms out there that can be, I'd say, more on the affordable side. But one thought is, you know, get involved in the ecosystem, because there's always a workshop somewhere on these type of topics. It might be legal, it might be HR specific, but to sort of, they talk about the do's and don'ts in this realm and scare the heck out of you. So every time I talk to an HR person, insurance person, an attorney, we get scared. We're all excited about building these businesses, and then, oh man, there's a lot of worries out there. You kind of take some of the fun out of it.
It's our job. No, I agree. I think there are some challenges with early stage companies. I find that most people, you know, understand the issues, are comfortable with the risks that are involved with it, because they're risking so much other stuff in their lives as a part of this process, that they understand that this is something, a goal that we're going to want to have as soon as we can get this in place. But until that point in time, we'll bear that risk.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, last question. Question number 10 from ChatGPT. How can I ensure my startup is in compliance with data protection and privacy laws, especially if I handle customer data?
You need advice from counsel. I mean, that one is something, because there are so many, I mean, especially, it really kind of depends on where you're going, where your information is going and where it's held. I mean, if you're having information in Europe, you have a whole nother system that you have to rely upon. California has its own system. Various states have their own system. Unfortunately, this is an area that you have to have a basic idea. I mean, there are form data policies that have all the, you could say meets the basic requirements. But that might be the form. You still need to implement that. You know, you need to be able to do what's in that form to be able to protect it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Chris, I appreciate you coming on the show. I want to give you closing thoughts. We have startups possibly listening. We have investors potentially listening. People that care about our community listening. Maybe closing thoughts to that ecosystem, to the backyard, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, although I feel like I'm an entrepreneur in some ways, because I truly respect the people who have very, very much passionate about what they're trying to do, put all their efforts and all their wealth into something to help make it work. I have not take those risks. And, you know, I really, really respect other people who do. And if, you know, we're here to help support you to what extent we can to help you navigate that process.
You help a lot. And thanks for coming on the show today, Chris.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for inviting me. All right.
Now, let's get Mark's perspective and closing thoughts from today's show. We're back to the Marquee Media Studio. It's the Mark Haney Show.
Great show today. I think it was educational in many ways, because as a startup, you know, there's just basic questions that you need to get answers for. And most of us can't just pick up the phone and call our attorney every time we have a basic question. So, you know, when we have guys like Chris Russell come on the show and share some of these basic questions, I hope you took some notes, because these are invaluable pieces of information. But also, I think it's important to realize which service providers are giving back to our backyard. Which of them are really putting themselves out there for us, the startups and the entrepreneurs? Who is out there who can answer those questions and is doing it out of the goodness of their heart in many cases? So thank you, Chris. Thank you, Stoll Reeves, for coming on the show. We talked a little bit about what's going to happen on October 5th and the Backyard Advantage coming to life at GFX. And it's going to be a great day. October 5th, you got to get your tickets. They're on sale now. Go to growthfactory.us. This is going to be the premier venture conference and entrepreneurial conference for the Sacramento region. Again, it's October 5th at the Grounds in Roseville, and you need to be there. We have big speakers lining up. We're going to have a lot of celebration around entrepreneurship and what's going on in Sacramento's venture capital. And again, at the heart of it is love. In Sacramento, we love one another. So it'll be bringing out all of those things. And I was really intrigued to hear Chris on the show talk about how the entrepreneurial ecosystem has progressed over the years. And my friends, it is accelerating fast. Love is beginning to show up in conversations. Just today at the Carlson Center, we're talking about love, and right, how entrepreneurs and venture capitalists and people that are leading at in major universities are beginning to show some love to entrepreneurs. So it is happening, my friends. And so I want to thank you. If you are a listener of this show and are a subscriber of this podcast, I mean, you're part of this change that is happening where many areas of California we hear about San Francisco are having tough times. Sacramento is on the rise, my friends, and it's because of you. So thank you for listening to this show, and really thank you to all of you out there that are fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship, and for all of you that are out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at the Mark Haney Show, here at Haney Biz, here at the Growth Factory, we are never above you. We're never below you. We're always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in this segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.